In this episode of Newton Talks, I've travelled all the way down to Portsmouth to speak to Sam Mason Bell and Jackson Batchelor, who are the creators and creative directors of Trash Arts, a filmmaking company and collective. Together, they have directed or produced multiple no-budget feature films, including Toxic Schlock, Conspiracy X, and Lonely Hearts, as well as the anthology series Trash Arts Killers. They've also produced and directed several web series and multiple short films. Today we talk about their filmmaking ethos, how they get their work out there, and what their ambitions are for the future. So tell me something initially then about how Trash Arts got started. What was the start point for Trash Arts?
I started Trash Arts in about 2007, and the original intention, it was like just to make films, and the name comes from the image of a Mona Lisa in a trash can, and we just thought, you know, we want to make films that are a bit like trashy and arty, as obvious as it sounds. It's those two mixes of being able to have a bit of fun with it, but also try and do something a bit strange and weird, or, you know, just kind of open to doing what we want, really, because we don't have anyone who's relying on us to produce something by this date or anything like that, so we can just do as we wish.
I think the name sort of like has the implication for us as well, that we try and make something out of nothing. So we try and make art out of essentially trash, out of, like, you know, we haven't got anything to put towards it necessarily, but we'll put everything we can into it and see what comes out.
So where are you getting funding from for this? Is it all personally private funding, or are you, is this a company that you've, a business that you're running here?
It's a weird one. Like, we are more of as a business, because we do different kind of film stuff. We have done paid jobs for, like, local businesses, or City Council, or the King's Theatre, or any kind of, like, local businesses.
Bands and things like that. We do music videos occasionally.
Yeah. So we do the odd project for financial gain in that regards. Also with our films, having, like, our VOD deals and stuff like that, so we kind of reach out funding that-wise. Other films we've worked on in the past, we've had other companies with us who have put funding into it. So we've been working with Hill Burton Films. We worked on Lonely Hearts, Millennial Killer, and Toxic Schlock with him on that. And even with, we've been working on Fixer recently with Merlin Films, who, although were not giving us, it wasn't like a financial thing, it was a support kind of thing. So we tend to work with other companies to help support them and for them to support us as well.
Yeah, we try to, I mean, we put our own money into it quite a bit, but we try to do things for as cheap as we can, you know, guerrilla style, kind of get out there, film something quickly and then move along so no one stops and questions us.
Knowing this, we kind of like, we try to make sure when we're writing or creating anything that we know that, it's the Robert Rodriguez attitude. It's going, right, we've got one location, we've got this kind of prop, this is the film we're going to make around this. We're going to make a feature film, it's going to be about 500 quid. We're going to make sure it doesn't go over to any other prices. And as Jackson said, some of our shoots, like a film we shoot last year called Decline, we kind of like shot throughout the year sporadically because we knew there were other things going on, and it made more flexibility. One of the things that we try to focus in on is flexibility with the people we work with, because we work with a lot of actors and filmmakers who aren't necessarily putting this as their main focus. We have to make sure that they're not going to get in trouble with their work or find conflictions in their own lives, so we can kind of create the perfect schedule for everyone.
And what that means sometimes is if an actor, you know, can't show up for whatever reason, you know, they're ill or, you know, something's happened, we will sort of try to ensure that we can do something on that day anyway, and like, you know, be flexible with our narrative, be flexible with what we're trying to actually achieve, because otherwise, you know, we sometimes won't get anything done because it, you know, someone's pulled out or, you know, last minute.
So when it comes to the, obviously you want to restrict the amount of locations, it's kind of like micro budget, those kind of micro budget rules, guidance and that, but in terms of the scheduling, you find sometimes the schedule spreads out, you don't try and do it in a shorter space of time to try and keep down the cost. You tend to do it at weekends, you tend to do it as and when.
It really depends on the kind of project. So for instance, Lonely Hearts, we had a hired location and it was only set on that location, so that was 3 days, that was the film, that was everything that was shot for the film was then. Whereas something like Fixer, which took about a year to shoot, we had to take different times with the time that people had. So like I said, we try to work to other people's schedules just to make it easier. The ideal scenario is to go, right, we got 2 days, we're going to shoot the whole entire film in these 2 days. But a lot of our work is, it's not so much working from screenplays, we work from an improvised bullet point. So by working from that, you get a lot more flexibility of being able to go, okay, they're not having to learn lines, they're having to turn up and be in character. So we can kind of spread it out a little bit more. Or, yeah, shoot a film in like 3 days where they're just staying in character the whole entire time.
I think it also depends on the film that we're actually trying to make. So if it is all set in one location, we'll be likely to be able to do it over either like a weekend or 2 weekends. Whereas if it's multiple locations all around the city, then we'll have to sort of, it will take about a year to just get people to those locations, film the scene, you know, and put it together like that.
This thing, our preference would obviously be just to have like 2 weeks to shoot the film without people having to run off to jobs and their normal lives, but you gotta work what you got.
It was easier when we were younger because like, no one had jobs or anything. So
what was the shortest amount of time that you took to make a feature film?
2 hours.
Yes, we shot a film in 2012 called The Drug Tours, and The Drug Tours was 2 continuous shots over 2 hours of a film crew, like a mockumentary, where they essentially visit 5 different drug dealers. And the way we did it is we had 2 cameras and they just consistently kept rolling. If the camera battery died, then they had to stay in character and get that battery sorted. We had sound problems, so we had to make that part of the character. And as the characters were supposed to be taking drugs and slowly feeling the effects whilst trying to make a documentary, it kind of added to the chaos. And yeah, we shot it over 2 hours and it's a crazy experience, and we definitely want to try and do something like that again, especially with horror. It's just working out the right idea that can be done in 2 hours, essentially.
And also how to do the horror effects without cutting and without, like, that's quite a difficult one to work ahead.
It's a challenge.
We've thought about it a number of times, but every time sort of come up flat with, like, yeah, how the hell are you going to do that?
It's a really exciting idea, the idea of making a feature film in that shorter space of time. And from what I know about actors as well, they find that really, really invigorating as well. Right, to stay in character for that time, almost treating it like a play, but yet a play that's taking place in a live location. I find that a really kind of exciting and inspiring concept.
I think that's the thing, like, especially with actors in your local city, like, we're not going to agents, we're not going to people who have film experience, we're going to people who have acting and that's what they want to do with their life, and a lot of them are from theatre, so they do really enjoy the improv. A lot of the older actors we work with, they're always saying that the improv is a lot easier for them to get their head around because they're in there, they're in their character, that's that. Whereas, yeah, like you said, it's like a stage performance in that regards. It's just about staying within what you are. And because some actors like to think of the comfortability of a film where they've got the option of a cut or a retake. But we try and get it in that one take kind of thing rather than doing multiple takes. It makes them more comfortable with who they're doing as a character, but it also kind of like, it doesn't allow them to think, oh, it's all right, on the 7th or 8th take, it'll be great.
So we can move on to talk a little bit about the casting now. Are you purely casting locally? How do you go about casting? Because a lot of your films, I'm thinking of, Drug Tours being one of them, but also Toxic Schlock, which I watched last night. You know, obviously, it's pushing actors in terms of their performances, right? In terms of what they're willing to do. So you've almost got people who are performers rather than kind of, I wouldn't call them kind of actors in that kind of actorly way, but they're people who are willing to just go for it, right? And so where are you finding these people? I find them, they come across as collaborators is what I'm trying to say. Do you find that?
Totally. I mean, that is the beautiful thing. Like, we try to always collaborate with the actors also in regards to, like, if they've got an idea, we'll try and explore how we can do that idea with them, or maybe specifically write something to what they want to do, or a character that they've never played before. So casting wise, we do tend to look locally, but we do look out city as well. We just know the constraints of like going straight to agents or going straight out of city. You want a bit more control and you want to be able to sit down with them and work with those characters more locally. You can do it online, of course, but yeah, like a lot of our actors, you also kind of get the idea, like you said, levels with actors. So when it comes to maybe violence or nudity or any of those kind of things, some actors are more accepting than others. And again, like, it's finding challenging, interesting roles that they're interested in. I always say to any actor, like, sure, if you've got limitations, that's fine, but read the role first. If it's a role you're interested in, great. If you're just doing the role because you want an acting role, then it's not really going to be worth it, you know?
I think as well, like we tend to cast sort of people that we haven't worked with before in smaller roles, and unless we kind of have a general sort of faith in the fact that they've acted a lot or they have like a lot of experience, we look for, you know, giving them small roles so that then we can test whether they can get along with our style, whether they can get along with the improv, essentially whether they're up to it, and then we'll look and think, all right, well then we could give them a bigger role, we can, you know, bring them in on this film because they look right for the part or something like that.
It's like when we worked with Martin on Toxic Schlock, who played the dad, we did Conspiracy X just beforehand so me and him could get a feel of how it works. And again, Conspiracy X was more of an improv bullet point film, whereas Toxic Schlock was a screenplay by me and Tony Newton. So again, it was nice to just get a feel of working with Martin. And the great thing with Martin is Martin has no limitations. He will do anything, but he will do it for the character. There'll be so much discussions about why he's going to do this and the reasoning. It's not just, I'll do anything because I don't have the ability. It's more, I have the ability and I want to do it completely and utterly right and push my limitations.
So with that in mind then, how much do you devote pre-shooting to rehearsal or talking with the actors informally about the characters and things like that? Because I'm thinking back to the drug tours. I mean, that would have taken a lot of rehearsal time, I would imagine, prior to shooting.
Well, in all honesty, we would prefer to have more time of rehearsal with actors. It's hard to get that time with them again due to their own schedules. There are certain films, like, I'll always, if I've got a main character or a couple of characters that really needs to focus in, I will spend time with those actors. Now, another fortunate thing with a lot of the actors we work with locally, they're friends of ours. So we build that bond with them. For instance, the film we shot last year, Decline, Ryan Carter, who was the main actor in that, we did spend loads of sessions going through the character. I would like to do it more in all the films, but to me, at this point, it depends on the project. So for instance, Drug Tours, we met up with the actors beforehand, but it really was a kind of, just go with the flow on this. There was no rehearsal. There was no rehearsal of any of those scenes. We just had the cameras there, your in character. When that camera's gone, go back to normal.
Yeah, I think that tends to be the way that we work with it, is we discuss the characters with the actors more so than rehearse the scenes with them, which is, it has its benefits and it has its drawbacks, because I think that, like, in some ways, if we rehearsed with them more, then we'd be more immediately into the scene, you know, we wouldn't have to do so much work there and then, but at the same time, it doesn't really take away from the performance itself necessarily, because as long as they know their characters, they know the kind of things that they say. And sometimes the actors will think of saying things that we wouldn't even have considered, you know, we wouldn't.
Especially within comedy and stuff, like, things, because we do mostly comedy and horror, and like, especially with horror, people seem to forget with horror that good characters does also mean good acting. We try to make sure our characters and our acting is good, because for one, the actors have the ability. We've asked them to be involved because we think they can act. And you need to just have that bit of confidence with them to make those characters stronger, because otherwise you just got a bunch of 2D characters and people are waiting for the end, for the big horror moment, you know?
I think one of the reasons why, I think the acting in your movies that I've seen, and I haven't seen all of your productions, but he's actually quite strong, and for this level I think that's a real credit. But I think part of the reason why the acting is strong to me, from an outsider looking in at your company, is that because you're giving the actors interesting things to do, right? Not only are you giving them improv, but they're also doing stuff that's quite mad, that gives them something to go and get involved with. They're active as actors, I think, whereas I think a lot of films at this level, the no budget level, have people not doing much at all. They don't tend to go for action and for there to be very active characters, and I think you do something very different there, and I think that really helps the performances, you know?
I think it's where as well you've got the dialogue itself. When dialogue's strictly sort of written and adhered to in the performance, it can come across as stilted, and it can be difficult for the actors to find that voice necessarily. Whereas when they're improvising, you know, like you're not relying on a female character saying the words that two men have written for her.
I think there's this weird thing with being conscious of stuff like that, like Jack said, in regards to, especially with like, yeah, females or older people, or just getting their right voice to come across with the character. Like, it feels too presumptuous nowadays to write certain things. Although you want those characters to do certain things, you want it just to be in their own voice, so you don't look at it and go, no one speaks like that. That's just how I've written that screenplay, and they've just followed with the words as opposed to putting anything within it, you know.
So in terms of directing things like the nudity that you have in your films, or any kind of messiness that you have in your films, what's the kind of vibe on set that you make sure that the cast are comfortable when you're directing those things?
Well, actually, a good example of that would be Lonely Hearts. Lonely Hearts has the most extreme nudity, and it really pushed the actors. But because the film was set on a camping site, we just literally, in between films, everyone's sitting around a fire, having some drinks, having a smoke, just feeling more like, come to us, relax, go back to the scene. Because the most key element to any of this is comfortability. If these actors aren't comfortable, they're not going to want to do what you want them to do. That also kind of helps with... Because a lot of our crew, again, is the friendly element, but we work with men, women, like whatever's comfortable for the set. So for Lonely Hearts, it was co-directed with me and Jess, and the big extreme nudity scene, she spent ages rehearsing with them, making sure they were comfortable. And again, they were having a few drinks to just relax a bit more, and we were just waiting by the side. And then when they came through the scene, they came out all good onto another scene. So it was like almost creating, I don't want to say the word safe space, somewhere for people to go to be able to escape the extremities of what they've just done and go, oh, actually, I'm still a human being. I'm still part of this group. It's all good, you know?
I think it's also that we tend to try and bring the crew down to as small as possible when we're dealing with scenes of nudity in. So most of those scenes will say that, well, the director will then use the camera as well, and we'll just have a sound person, or we'll rig the room so that there's sound in the room, kind of thing. Just to make sure that it's not like this feeling of a load of people stood around watching someone the nudie.
That's the truth. We don't want to create that for people. We don't want people to think that this is just some perverse fit experience for all of us to enjoy and remember. It's about the performance and what they're doing in that scene. If there's a vicious, like, freeway rape, murder, nastiness, you don't need a bunch of people standing around going... You just need people to do that after they've seen the scene, when it's edited, when it's in post-production, they've watched it in the film. And when you see the reaction, especially in Lonely Hearts, to particular scenes at festivals, you know you've done the job. And even if they're terribly disturbed, you know you've done the job. And that no one was hurt in the process. Because I've heard of different film sets where people haven't been comfortable and certain people have wanted to push for certain things. And you're just like, why? You're not a filmmaker. You're just doing it for your own kicks, really.
So do you find that you work a lot with the same kind of cast repeatedly? Do you find that they often come to you with any ideas to originate movies and stuff? Because you also facilitate, through Trash Art, the production of other people's films. Is that correct?
Yes. That's the thing. Like, we have a lot of different ideas. And one of the things that we've been doing in the last couple of years is basically helping people to do their first feature film. We've never done a feature film, but making sure there's at least one of us involved to keep it moving, because we've done it so many times. And we do get different ideas from other people who want to, like, create different stuff. So we've had someone last year who wanted to do a documentary about a dance group called Neptune Girls, and it's an empowerment dance group in Portsmouth. And again, not exactly the kind of thing that we would naturally reach out to, but she's an actress with us, Ashley Swain, and I wanted to help her. And again, it encourages her then afterwards to go towards films. One of the things that we also like to do with web series and horror anthologies, web series has its rules in place. So we've got our show, we know how it works. And then we get someone who maybe hasn't directed much. Again, a lot of the cast end up directing the episodes. And they got those rules in place. Same with a horror anthology. It's got a theme, it's got a time duration. And my mind is like, if you can make a horror film for this anthology, that's your steps to being able to then start making films off your own back. It's just people need to get that encouragement just to go forwards with it.
And even with certain projects, I mean, there's with Right Here, Right Now, the making of, we invite some of the cast to direct who aren't, they're not really interested in becoming filmmakers of their own right or anything like that necessarily. But they've been on the project for so long and they know how to do it, they know how to direct, and they want to direct that specifically. And so we just invite them on and help them with that.
And Right Here, Right Now, that's your web series, is that?
Yeah, we have two web series. We've got Right Here, Right Now, which ends in December. That's a political, well, it's kind of like a satire of a podcast. And there was two reasons why I wanted to do it. The first reason was, in 2016, things went very crazy for the world. I wanted something to be able to do a release, to do a topical thing, but to give it a downward spiral, because I love downward spirals, and for them to not know what they're doing, and it's more about their ego and personality, etc. And also, I'm a big fan of Larry Sanders' show, and I wanted to do a similar format of having a producer, a sidekick, and the host, and just seeing all the behind the scenes.
What was your other web series?
The Making Of, which is a it's a mockumentary that follows young filmmakers trying to make it into make films off their own back, similar to how we are, and we sort of taking a piss out of ourselves really during that. And it's a lot of fun. Sam plays the main character, who is a lot more bumbling and foolish than Sam himself is.
Yes, which is a lot of fun to play. And like, one of the reasons why we extended that into a web series, we did a short film for Colchester's 60-hour film challenge in 2015, and we decided to do a film about trying to make a film in 60 hours. And from doing that, we got into the top 10, which was really cool, and the cast were kind of like, we could do more of this. And we sat on it for about a year, because we were still working out where exactly what we were planning to do. And then, yeah, we're in our fourth season now. And yeah, it will be completed again next year, because we want to try and finish the web series so we can really start feeling like 2020 fresh, get some new ideas going.
So alongside that, you've got your you do your anthology Trash Art Killer. So you've done two volumes of that. Is that
yes,
correct? And so that's when you bring in the kind of, how do you go about producing those anthologies, because you've got different directors and different writers for the different segments?
Well, again, from the experience of working with Tony Newton from Vestra Pictures, who does most of the anthologies that we start with, like Maniacal, Home Videos, Conspiracy, X, Score Theatre. With Trash Arts Killers, it really was that chance to go, okay, so we've got people who want to make films. Just get them to make a horror film, and we can just work with them. And some of the filmmakers within the Trash Arts Killers, yeah, some of them are first-timers, like Martina Madesh with her film Desire in the first one. Again, this was a short film that I helped with a university project, but afterwards I was like, this is really good, can I put it in the volume? So a lot of Trash Arts Killers is going to other filmmakers and going, I like your work, can I put it in the film?
So the films already exist?
Some of them do. I try to make it that it's not like that, but at the same time, I want the volume to be complete. So, yeah, like, there are some people, like a guy called Robbie Hampstead, Thomas Davenport. They're all filmmakers who've either pre-done a film for us and we haven't put it in anything, so we put it in Trash House Killers, or we approach them. So in the first one, there's a film that I did with Chris Mills from Lonely Hearts towards the end of it, Attraction. We wrote that idea for the anthology. And I'm currently setting up Trash Arts Killers Volume 3 at the moment, talking to other filmmakers, or again, people within Trash Arts who want to make films, and going, look, develop a horror idea, let's put it in this.
But also, if you market it, because we market it online to look at getting those filmmakers in, so people will just message us or send us an email, or you know, get in contact with us in some capacity, and we'll find a way to get whatever they're doing or whatever they want to do into one of our anthology films, because we just don't like wasting work, I think, is part of it. Sometimes there's anthologies that, you know, we've got a plan for and we can't get enough films for them, so we've got a couple of films, you know, made up for this anthology that's never going to happen, so we end up, you know, essentially shifting them into other anthologies that they can go out in.
The thing with anthologies, there's like two approaches. From the first approach that we had so many filmmakers sending us stuff, and it wasn't always necessarily right for the anthology, but we were like, let's give them a voice, let's still release it, let's get it out there. The other approach we were taking with anthologies, which is what we're probably going to be doing more so, and we've started with a film called Parapsych Trauma, and essentially with that anthology, I wrote the script for it, so we wrote an actual screenplay, and we chose the filmmakers to be more localized. So Jackson directs one, Simon Berry, one of our actors, directs one, Martin directs one, and Mike Reed, another filmmaker we work with, and they had their own, like, so the scripts within it that Jack did, we both co-wrote it, Martin rewrote his one, but it had more creative control, so we weren't expecting them just to go, right, here's your concept, go and make a short film. It's like, here's your actual script, go and do that. And we want to do that more. The one reason why we haven't done it more is because it's the kind of thing where you need a budget. So doing this one thing, Parasite Trauma, has taken nearly 3 years, and it's been very complex. And although this was the year that we actually shot it, it was arranging to get the right location, to get the director to work with the actors, because we were casting and choosing the people. And sometimes the talents didn't fit. I'd want to do more of that stuff, though, because it is more interesting to have that creative control in an anthology, just to give it a bit more coherency.
Yeah, because the whole idea of that was that Sam wrote every short film in it, and so it's got this real sort of overarching narrative where every story has an element that you know they all essentially link together. But what we did was, like we said, if we have different directors for each one, well, then we will see these different styles and different types of performance and things like that come out. And it's really incredible, because editing it now, we can see how, I mean, we only shot them on phones, this whole thing. But seeing how everyone has used the camera on a phone so differently, how everyone has sort of drawn different elements out of the narrative and seen different things in the narrative. We've got this complete piece that really feels like it's interlinked, but also feels like separate segments. And I think it's quite a unique way to do an anthology. I mean, yeah,
hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
No, that sounds great. So you've got multiple kind of schedules crossing over with each other here. You've got some films that are taking 3 years, some films that are taking 2 hours. How do you juggle having these ideas crossing over with each other?
The truth is, the more you realise it, every film has a journey. And that journey is usually maybe 3 or 4 years. So by the point when you create it, from casting, from shooting it, from post-production, from getting a distributor, from the release. So when you have multiple schedules happening at once, it actually, personally, I find it's not too stressful. So for instance, like this year, the films that we completed in 2018, Millennial Killer and The Truth Will Out, they've done all their post-production, and now they're with Darkside to be released for next year. And by the end of this year, we'll have 5 different feature films at the post-production soundstage. And that's another thing, because there's different stages, especially with sound and music. To me, like when a film's in that stage, I'm more freely to go, okay, I can work on something new, because it's with someone else. Someone else is doing the sound design, someone else is scoring it. I can start working on a different concept. But it's also with scheduling, there's a lot of notice. So with Jackson's film Monstrous, we start in September, we have to continue again in November. But we make sure there's enough distance between whatever else is happening close by it. And it just about works. Like I said, because of the fact that I just want to create and stuff, I will sit and manage schedules all day. And I think it helps from doing events promotion that I'm kind of used to just scheduling in when's good for people. And my mind works like that in a horrible way as it is. So it does help.
Yeah, Sam doesn't find it stressful. I find it difficult sometimes to work out what we're doing and to keep things in my mind of what's the next project that we're actually working on. Fortunately, Sam reminds me, so it makes it easier.
When I have this thing, I think that actually finishing a production is probably the hardest thing to actually do, to finish it completely and kind of and get it out and put a full stop on it.
Most definitely. On a film. There's a film we had called The Animals, which is on our YouTube channel and Stream Now TV. And essentially, that film, we started in 2014, and it was just before we got a bunch of new equipment. So we shot it with old equipment, and then we got new equipment. We're like, oh, God, all right, we have to use the old equipment because we want it to look the same. And we finished shooting it in 2017, simply because we had a laptop collapse, so we had to edit the whole entire thing from the start again, scheduling again with actors. One of the things about the laptop collapsing is we were allowed to look at the film and go, actually, let's move that scene to the beginning. Perhaps we could do an extra scene here. And again, we were shooting other things in between, because if you're waiting on something, if you're just waiting on that one project, to me, you're more likely to stop making films, because you've put all of this love into this one thing and it's not working because you've got a normal life. You don't have all the time to commit just to that. So for me, setting up multiple different projects with different people, it keeps the machine rolling. And in a weird way, because Trash Art's been going so long and we have so many films, I kind of have to see it like a production line, that this is the next one going out and then this one's going out. And keeping an eye on everyone and making sure they're comfortable with their project. If there's any point someone's like, I need more time, you go, have all the time you want. There's no one here like hitting you over the head going, no, you've got to get it done by here, this is when the release date is. We just don't work like that, which allows it to be, you can have so many multiple things happening freely.
I think that's part of the benefit of not having massive amounts of funding or people producing our work other than ourselves and companies that we'd sort of trust and work with closely. Because you don't have the deadlines, you don't have someone there over your head going like, well, I've put this much money in, where's the outcome? When's this going to happen? So it does give you more freedom in some senses. Obviously, you know, money would still be nice. Yeah.
So how are you so prolific? Because you're turning over films at an extremely fast rate here. I mean, not only just the short films, but the ones that you're helping other people doing. And how many feature films have you made in the last 12 months?
five, I think.
Five. Okay. So how are you so prolific? Do you think? What is your secret?
I just think it's one of the things that's definitely helped us is we used to do film challenges. So we used to do 48-hour film challenges. And it allows you to get a bit of discipline, the principle of going, okay, we're going to get this done on schedule. It's not about hitting the deadlines in the final production like you would have a film challenge. It's more about knowing that you have a schedule and knowing that we can hit it, we can get these scenes done. Plus, because we enjoy it so much, and editing is kind of like, I love editing. So I just finish clips, come home, look at the clips and go, all right, shall I edit tonight? Yeah, I could probably get it done. So right here, right now, for instance, takes about 2.5 hours to shoot. It takes me about 2 hours to edit. And again, it's just because we've been repeating the same formula over and over again. And I think if you repeat something that works, then it works. You know, and it's hard for me to say because I know so many people who are making films constantly and they always say, why do you do so many? And I'm like, it's just how my mind works. Can't do it any other way. Unfortunately, I have a lot of people who are, that I'm grateful go along with that.
What's your exhibition and distribution strategy?
Essentially, again, depending on each project, for me, like, I've learned so much in the last few last few years. So one of the things with non-exclusive rights always felt like, well, why wouldn't you want it exclusive? Because then they're going to put more work into it. But the same thing, if you can get, like, a feature film that was made in 2012 out to non-exclusive sites such as Versus Media or StreamNow TV or any of those real small little indies that are on Rukus and VODs and all that kind of stuff, then you can get your work out to multiple people and not feel like you're being unfair to everyone. So when people just shove stuff onto YouTube, it's like, throw another non-exclusive sites. And all it takes is a bit of Googling. Like with Versus Media, that was just a friend who was like, oh, do you want to speak to these guys? And one of the things that I like to do, and maybe it's not always the best approach, I like to keep relationships with people I work with. So if I'm talking to a distributor, I'm asking them, how can I help you? Do you want me to edit a little trailer together? Would you like some promo? Here's some films that I'm looking to do. Are you interested in anything that's exclusive? It's keeping that relationship so they've got their options open, so they know when they look at Trash Arts, they're going, ah, these guys have got stuff, and they'll get stuff done. And I think you can only do that by being open with who you are as a business. The same with, in particular with horror and stuff as well, with approaching sales agents and stuff like that. I said to you before we start recording, we just send out emails. And you send out an email to the distributor, and sure, it's like, it's almost cold calling, but it's the only way we can get a response. And you will get some people to say, sorry, not interested, or some people go, I am interested, but you need to send me this, and you're like, well, that's more than our production's going to cost if you want all that stuff. And it is very... Sending hard drives consists constantly over to America and Canada with films gets costly.
Yeah, it's frustrating because there'll always be like a small problem with the file formatting or something like that, and you do kind of wonder to yourself, are they just collecting up these hard drives to like sell on or something? What's going on here?
And that's it. With the distributors that we work with, Darkside, our sales agent for Lonely Hearts and soon to be True for That Millennial Killer, we are looking to just consistently keep sending him stuff because we have stuff and it makes sense. And I talked to Vince from Darkside, a lovely guy who seems to have similar ideologies in looking after, because like as a community you support what the bigger thing is, but you make sure everyone else is working together. It's almost borderline a socialist kind of idea, and it's kind of like what we try to bring into working with other people. It's the same with what's the other ones we work with, Sector 5, who have Home Videos and Maniacal. And Troma are good to work with. They give communication, they tend to respond a lot and they get stuff out there. And for me, Troma, if anything, it's more about like their brand, of being part of that brand, as opposed to like everything they do in that regards. But again, I just emailed them, and it helped that talking to people like Tony Newton, who knew other distributors, I would talk to him. He'd introduce me to people, and it's just constantly talking to people. And when I say I'm talking, I'm talking just sitting Facebooking and emailing and just getting responses.
I think the like part of the problem, I've been discussing this way too much recently, but part of the problem with particularly filmmakers like ourselves, working class, is that feeling of imposter syndrome. Like if you're sending out your film to all of these companies and things, you're thinking like, oh, it's not good enough, I'm not good enough, they're not going to take me seriously. And actually it's just about getting over that and saying, no, I might as well just send it and see what happens. See if they take it. See if they, you know, if they say no, that's the worst that can happen, really, isn't it?
So how do you go then about handling any kind of criticism that you might get then about your films? Do you?
Well, the fact is, we're called Trash Arts. We make films that are trashy. You're going to get criticism. And when people don't like the work, like, it's like that simple concept of knowing that you're not an award winner, but it's nice if you can get selected. Like, you make certain films that aren't really there for everybody. We haven't made anything where we're expecting a whole audience to be like, yeah, no problems with that, I liked all the ideas there. So when you know that, it's like, I don't really care about criticism. I appreciate criticism and I take it on board, and we try to change things, and we also are very self-critical of our own work. It's one of the things I've always believed in, is keep making stuff, because eventually you're going to make a lot of mistakes, and mistakes are good to learn from. Otherwise you are blindsided by thinking you're the greatest filmmaker ever and not acknowledging the fact that maybe you could learn to change a few little things. Story points, like I've had with festival screens like Lonely Hearts and stuff, when people react to certain scenes, it's kind of like, well, you knew what you were walking into. there's that element of like, I'm not going to apologise for something that upset you. You know, it's, we make films that might make you have to question things a little bit, you know?
Yeah, and sometimes the point of the scene is to upset people. You know, like, you kind of want to create that controversy to a certain point. But I think also, like, where, like, when we've been reading through film reviewers, you know, their reviews of our films, quite often you'll find that we've found that the criticism that they make is something that we've said ourselves about the problem with the film. And we know that we're only developing, we're moving forward, we're always going to be looking to do better and bigger and, you know, keep moving forward. So when you see that kind of criticism, you kind of just think, oh, well, you know, that's what we did like last year or 2 years ago or something. We're better now. So we don't need to.
It's good to be constantly analytical of what you're doing, you know, like even questioning the ethical moral reasons for why you want to do that. But there's usually a decent enough reason for why you started it. And if someone doesn't like it, it's a new conversation to have, you know?
So in terms of, maybe this is the wrong question, and feel free not to answer this, but what, with the level that you're working on with these VOD sites, another non-exclusive, FOD company, sorry, non-exclusive sites, what kind of return are you getting on that?
It's hard to say. For one, like with our sales agent with Lonely Hearts, it only came out in America and Canada at the beginning of September. So we won't know the financial gain from doing that until next year. But there have been some films, like I've produced a few films where I've made a nice bit of money. Not a lot. It's always random bits of money. It's never consistent. It's just now and then it'd be like, oh, you've earned £1,000 from producing this film. Or, oh, here's some sales reports. You've got £100 for this. And like some non-exclusives as well will do a year-long kind of contract. So when it comes to December, they're like, right, we're going to renew you again for another year. Here's like £700 or whatever. And again, it's not huge amounts of money, and we are working with other companies to raise that, but at the same time, like, it's just getting it out there at this point and not being bogged down by, oh, we should be earning more money, because you start creating when you start focusing on, why am I not earning enough?
So when you put it on, you put your films on YouTube and on, and so is there any conflict there in terms of putting stuff on YouTube and then putting?
It's a weird one, because I always thought there'd be a conflict. Like, I always felt bad about going, right, so I've given you exclusive for this, but now I'm going to release it on this channel and I'm going to release it on YouTube. I'll talk to them about it and say, this is what I want to do. I'm doing it for this reason. And most of the response I get is always like, sounds good. More people will see it. The fact is, a lot of our VOD sites are American. So our audience in Portsmouth, our localized audience, will not get the chance to see that. So that's kind of like how I see YouTube, is to give them the opportunity, but the main focus of promotion is on the more non-exclusive VOD sites.
I think the reason that they're not so actually worried about YouTube is because it's a mess of everything. There's so much content on YouTube that if you're looking for specific things, it's sometimes really hard to find it. And these VOD sites have their own audiences that they've built up and that they've created that wouldn't see the content on YouTube. They wouldn't be able to find it. So it means that their only way of seeing it is through VODs. And you can do that in multiple different countries and things, whereas YouTube, I don't know if they everywhere has access to YouTube even.
It's also one of those things where, like, so for instance, anthology horrors or any, particularly in the horror films, because they have distribution deals with non-exclusive deals, those kind of films, I've made so many short films for anthologies that are straight out to those right, this is exclusive, it has to go like that. And I'm cool with that. I'm more than happy with that because that's what it was designed for. Whereas something like Right Here, Right Now, or the making of it, it was just made. So getting it out as many places as possible makes more sense.
So in terms of that, then, you're talking about, like, it'd be nice to have more money here, there, maybe another. But what kind of filmmaking ambitions do you have? What filmmaking? Have you got any filmmaking ambitions in terms of creative ambitions or logistical ambitions?
I mean, if I had the ideal dream, would be to turn Trash Arts into a studio to be able to facilitate more filmmakers who feel like they're not going to be able to do it, so we can work with them to go, right, we've got a concept for you, you're going to direct this, this person's going to help you, and we're going to get more films coming out of Trash Arts. So it kind of, it helps Trash Arts, it helps them to have a starting point. That's where I want to go. I want to be a studio with our own VOD site and all those kind of extreme things in the future,
a bit like Troma have been.
Yes, yeah that's the thing. And again, same as Kaufman, I've still created my own work. I still want to be directing films till I die, and I have bigger, ambitious films I want to do, but I'm 30 years old. I've still got plenty of time to start prioritising those. The moment is getting the company in a good position so we can hopefully, in the future, encourage investors to invest in the company so we can start setting up these very low-budget films for first-time filmmakers, like almost like an initiative. That's something that we want to do in the future at some point.
Yeah, I think for me the ambition is much more sort of vague than that. And I love the idea of becoming a studio, but I just want to affect people, have some sort of, you know, impact upon people that see your films, that they remember it, that they have an experience that might make them think differently about things or might change their life in some capacity. Even if it's only in a most minor way, you know, I don't think that we're going to convince people out of, I don't know, big problems or anything, but
it's that same thing with legacy. It's like we were talking beforehand about Michael J. Murphy, and Michael J. Murphy, when he died, he's still working part time and he was living like, I don't know, about half an hour down the road from where we are now, so like North End, Portsmouth. And at first it was this kind of impression of, oh, no one knows him, no one's ever, well, you know, he should be well known. But then I've met more filmmakers. I've met people from like the Midlands from going to Horror on Sea and stuff like that. And they know who he is. And that's, to me, legacy is so much more important. And I think that's what I'm learning as well from these films we made in 2012. And now we've got companies around the world interested in them. And it's like, well, that's the legacy. It's knowing that there's a whole stable of work as opposed to just focusing on the artist. So I'm quite keen on that. We discussed it ages ago, but I don't tend to write a Sam Mason Bell film. I try to brand it as Trash Arts, because if that can get somewhere, then that benefits everyone who we've been trying to support and help.
So the company is a public company. How does that work? It's rather than just the Trash Arts name, you're operating it as an actual company, kind of ingoings and outgoings. What's the situation?
Yeah, we're a limited
company.
Feel free
not to answer if anything.
No, honestly, it's fine. Like, we're just a limited company.
We set it up really so that we could apply for funding.
Yeah.
Because we're not like a business per se with constant ingoing and outgoing expenditure.
And we have about, I don't know, it's hard to describe how many people are involved with Trash Arts, because people come in and out. We've always said to people, look, if you want to work with us, great. But if you've got other stuff, come back later. You don't have to feel the pressure of, you're part of the team, so you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this. That's why we always generally say that me and Jack are like the forefront of Trash Arts, and everyone else behind they can like do whatever they want creatively with other stuff. And I think, it does help in that regards, because then people don't see it as like, oh, they're a business. People like to call us a community, and it's a much nicer sense, because it's what we're trying to do is help others and to help the company and what we do, you know.
So out of your own films then, what's your favourite one that you've made? Maybe Sam, if you go through what your favourite film is that you've made in Trash Arts, and then I'll move on to Jackson.
There's two films I really love. I mean, there's love for all the films, of course, but I loved making Lonely Hearts because, again, it was on a more extreme level, and it was shot over 3 days. I loved that. I just loved doing that. I absolutely adored working with Jess and the actors involved. And because it was docu-horror, I love docu-horror because it's got those similar elements to mockumentary. It's leading you into believing you're watching a reality show or a documentary, and then go, oh, wait, sorry, you're in a horror film. And then throwing them back into it. It disturbs people because they've had to believe these people are real because the camera's constantly filming. It's constantly grabbing all those moments. The other film that I've really enjoyed making, and I'm hoping it's the best film I've made, it's still in post-production, is Decline. Because Decline, it was just something about it. I just really got into the swing of pacing. Because sometimes I know there's pacing issues within the films we make. And this one, it was right, we need to really focus in on that aspect. And having a good character piece focus that's to do with toxic masculinity, but also having like serial killer elements. And it was just so much fun seeing that coming together. And then now it's in the sound, I'm really like looking forward to it. Even though it's a bloody grim experience, it's more like, it just felt like more the kind of film I want to make, if that makes sense.
I don't know if I can answer this question. It's really hard because I honestly love most of the projects that obviously all of the projects that we do, but you know there are ones that I have more closer to my heart. I mean, I think the making of for me is something that I'm very close to because I just really like self-parody and things like that. But I think the reason that I can't pick one is because I don't want to be limited to any kind of genre or anything. I want to be able to just continuously do different things and try different things and experiment. And I don't know.
What kind of filmmakers would you say are your main inspirations here? I'm talking about kind of on screen rather than the company logistical kind of thing, because I'm guessing obviously kind of Corman and Rodriguez, we're talking about these guys already that who are obviously clearly an inspiration, right? But what about on screen?
And as far as like on screen, again, like people like I'm a massive fan of David Cronenberg. I adore David Cronenberg's work, same with David Lynch and Darren Aronofsky. I tend to like films that when I was younger I was very auteur driven, so I was desperately searching out every film by Cronenberg or every film by Almodovar or Park Chan-wook or any of those kind of people. The older I've got, I found myself still very driven by like loving auteur's work, but finding inspiration on a creative sense, I've tried to kind of remove myself from that. So I have no interest in making a Cronenberg film because he does it well. He does it beautifully. I can take aspects and try to do its own thing, but I don't want to just copy it. It's like that whole thing about artists still, they don't borrow. They steal ideas and take it and create it into their own work, as opposed to just kind of like, I'm going to make my own Lynch film, right? I'm going to do exactly the same composition as Wes Anderson. It's like, well, why are you doing that? You're doing it as a homage, but it almost falls into fan movies. And I feel like you should just take aspects. So a film that me and my partner, Emma Jane Lloyd, done called With the Right Conditions, it was her first film. So I found different films that I loved and I wanted to bring into it, like Cronenberg's Videodrome and stuff like that. And although it wasn't like, watch this and copy it directly, it's more like, just see the feel, get the vibe of the reasoning as to why he did it like this, and then we're going to try and do something similar. But it's nice to have certain vibes to like click off, but because I love films and I do love a lot of filmmakers. I love John Carpenter, I love George A. Romero, I love their work, I just don't want to copy their work.
He's basically mentioned everyone that I like as well, so it's it's difficult.
And I think a lot of those guys are always inspiring to horror filmmakers anyway, and especially kind of low-budget horror filmmakers, because they had their origins in very low-budget homemade, micro budget, guerrilla style filmmaking anyway, right? So it's that makes pure sense. So let's round it up. What's next? What's on the immediate horizon for Trash Arts in terms of the films you're making?
We're currently in production and in post-production on a couple of features. So Jackson's currently shooting Monstrous, which is a Brexit monster movie. Another guy within our company called Ryan Carter is making a film called The Unwanted, which is another docu-horror about ghost hunting. So those films that I had declined, those are the ones we shot this year, ready for next year. Me personally, I'm currently setting up a couple of films because I had two film ideas where it's like two actors, different projects, and I thought, all right, I can do those. So I want to do those at the beginning of the year. I'm not going to talk about them too much yet because you never know, they might not happen. The other thing that I signed up to yesterday, and we've been working on it for years, the filmmaker called Dustin Ferguson, who's based in LA, he asked us to reboot one of his slasher films that he made in 2009 called Terror at Black Tree Forest. So we're rebooting that. We've just started working on the script, and we were supposed to do this a couple of years ago, but we tried to make the script too far away from a slasher, whereas now we're coming back to what it should be, and now it's coming together, and I've started asking actors, because he's made my life easier, he said, I want it done by this time. So now I'm like, all right, let's get this moving.
And that was an American movie?
Yes.
And you're remaking it in Portsmouth?
We're going to remake it in Hampshire around like the trees and like surrounding areas, because it's just a woodland kind of kids going out camping with a slasher character. And again, it's really fun to take something that generally considered to be low grade by just having fun with it, because there's so many things to enjoy when making a good slasher film. And that's something that we've always wanted to explore, and we've been trying to think of, again, as a production company, we're like, right, we need to make something a little bit more, not mainstream, but something that has the possibility of continuation. Everything we usually do is quite grim and nihilistic as far as the story is ending. So with this, we have the possibility to do that, because we know that at some point in the future, if we want to get more things happening, we want to get commissioned from other filmmakers. So doing this, it's kind of like, it's that step towards that.
Yeah, I think... God, I can't remember the question now. It's just gone.
What's next?
What's next? We've been working on a few scripts recently as well. I think we're simultaneously writing three different horror films, and we're sort of considering, we're weighing up whether to try and see whether we can make these ourselves, although they're a bit higher budget, or to try and sell them or find someone who would be willing to make them. I think it's branching out now for us and finding other filmmakers to work with and to sort of bring under either our umbrella or to sort of, you know, go under their umbrella for a bit, see what we can do in terms of that.
Sam and Jackson, thank you very much for giving me your time. I really enjoyed that chat.
Thank you.
That was Sam Mason Bell and Jackson Batchelor, the creative directors of Trash Arts in Portsmouth. Thanks for listening. Newton Talks will return.